Welcome, travelers. Hey, come in. Take a seat and pour yourself a drink as you listen to Not Just NPCs Podcast. Here's your hosts, your guides, if you will, Krios and Sprocket.
Welcome back to another episode of Not Just NPCs Podcast. I'm your host, Krios, joined always by my co-host, Sprocket.
Hello.
You ready for today?
Oh, yeah, always.
This is going to be a fun episode, I think.
I think so, too.
We're going to be talking about homebrew rules. And we each did some research on different people and the homebrew rules that they use for their own Dungeons & Dragons games. I don't know which ones you found, so we might have some duplicates, which is okay. If that's the case, we'll just talk about it, and I'll just cross off my list. You can cross off yours. And yeah, I found quite a few. So we'll see if we end up doing two episodes of this or not.
Oh, which would be cool. Yeah, I just found out like a hodgepodge, like multiple forums discussing different fun things that they do. Like nothing groundbreaking, nothing game changing. I mean, some of them kind of are actually, but in general, it's just kind of like flavor, which for role playing, you know, I love. So it's mostly that, which I get a kick out of.
Yeah, mine are less flavor, I think, and more mechanical, maybe, is the word.
Yeah,
They're more on, like, the DM. This would be good for you to use. Do you want to start, or do you want me to start?
I could start out, because the first one I have is, like, really simple. Like, just a, like...
All right.
It's like almost, simple. Like, just a fun example, really. One thing this particular DM liked to do was, for his campaign, this, again, is, like, a big... The way he described it was, like, it's a big, like... homebrew, like it's his story. It's not like an actual like D&D model or anything. So his character, or his players rather, and their characters had to do a lot of creating their own backstory. So it was, their backstory really mattered to his homebrew, how he introduced NPCs into it and that kind of thing. So I say all that to say, a really cool thing is that as his characters progressed through whatever storyline and city, whatever, he would pop up, you know, random people from their past. Like they had to have like a giant list and all this kind of fun stuff. Yeah. And as these people from the past would pop up based on where the characters were and how long they've been in the story and the adventure, no matter what the situation, the character had to roll 1d10 to see if they remembered who this person was. And I thought that was a really cool idea, because it's not just like, well, you know, to say me as a player, you know, I wrote the story for my character. Yep. So of course I know who XYZ is, or of course I know who their parents are, or whatever. It's like, no, because you've been in the thick of it and all this crap has been happening to you in your life.
Yeah.
This person's now walked up to you on the street. They're like, oh my God, Sprocket, it's been decades since I've seen you.
Yeah.
Roll a D10 and see if you know who the heck this person is.
Yeah, that's cool. Know?
I thought that was kind of a neat idea, and for them, because it was very story-based, it really mattered if you knew that person, and that would therefore then impact where that would go next in the story. Like, if you don't really remember them, that would maybe, like, insult this person, just for example. And now, whatever piece of the puzzle they're going to do for you in the story, maybe now is cut off, and that drastically changes where your character's going to go. And I thought that was kind of interesting, not just... Hey, write like a 2-page character history and remember everything for your character. It's like, but does your character remember everything that you wrote down?
Yeah,
you
know, no,
in its own way.
That's interesting. I think it's definitely more intended to for those NPCs in your past rather than the present ones, you know, like, for instance, your wife or your husband.
Oh, 1,000%. Like, yeah.
Who are you? Yeah, I rolled a one. I have no idea. That would be your wife.
You're right. Unless they were stricken with explosive amnesia, I feel like they should know who their spouse is. But yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, I think it because he didn't break it all down, like what the story was.
Right.
I'm sure it was, it had to be a rich tapestry of, this is some guy at Wizards College that you roomed with, you know, do you remember his name? You know, kind of thing.
Yeah, and you could even do, because not a lot of people write detailed backstories. Let's be real. The types of people love to do that. And I love the people that love to do that. And then there's types of people that don't, that's
Thank
okay.
That.
It's just, it's just hard to incorporate your character as much as I can with other people. you could even, as a DM, for the people that maybe not necessarily don't go very detailed in their backstory, or even for those that do, have a character come up that's not even in their backstory at all, and have them roll a D10, and then you can say, yeah, no, you don't know who this person is. Or, yeah, you know who this person is. It's actually, like you said, the person you bumped with, but you had no relationship with them, really. They just recognized you, and you recognize that. And maybe that's an NPC that now gives you a quest. Like, hey, man, it's been a long time. I could really use your help with something.
That's cool. And it, like, turns out to be, again, not game-breaking-wise, but turns out to be, like, some sort of reward for your character to complete that quest. But if you don't remember them, then that quest is now gone, and the DM can secretly scratch off that reward because, oh, you didn't remember, you know, luck of the dice, luck of your memory. Because, I mean, you know, there's some realism to that, right? Like, some people you run into.
It's Oh, yeah, I don't remember half the people from my past.
No, me neither. You know, we all joke about Superman. All he does is put on the glasses to become Clark Kent. And everybody, like, there, you know, we all joke, but there's a little bit of realism to that. You know, you change your clothes, you put on your glasses, he does his hair different. I mean, yeah, maybe. I mean, you know, the people he works with, they should be.
They're definitely smarter, rolling below five on all.
Yeah, hands down. Yeah. But it's like the rest of the people around him that don't see him day to day, it's like, yeah, that actually is kind of enough, really, to really change how you look. So that was my opening one, my mini.
I like it. I like it. I might actually use that one. That's a decent one.
So which one do you have? Throw it at me.
This one has to do with initiative. One player rolls for all the players at the table. So, for instance, I'm the DM, you're a player. And then we have three other friends with us that we're playing with. You would roll for your entire group, and I would roll for all the monsters. Then whoever rolls high, you would then take the highest initiative bonus from your group, and I would take the highest initiative bonus from my monsters and add it to your roll. Then whoever rolls the highest gets to go first. However, you alternate. So if you rolled highest, then your group would then get to decide which of you went first between all of you. Then, so you would become, you would go combat first, and then I would go with whoever I wanted to go first. And then we'd go back to you guys, and you'd be like, okay, which of your group wants to go second, aka in the actual order going third. And then whoever, fourth in order would be a monster of my choice. And you would do that for the whole round. And then starting the next round, if you wanted to, you could change the order. You would still stick with the alternating order.
Yeah.
And then I'm guessing if there's more monsters or more people, it just, the order just stops alternating until it ends the round, would be my guess.
Yeah.
I think it's more related to players being able to have their strong people go first, or for you to be able to set up something. For instance, hey, I'm gonna go first so I can cast, you know, this spell to aid and assist you guys, so that way when your turn comes you can have an advantage on attacking or something. And then for the DM, it allows me to take my big bad evil guy, and instead of having him go last in the order and getting his butt kicked until he's half dead already before he even gets to take a turn, he can go first, or I can have him go last and have a bunch of minions ahead of him protecting him. So it allows for more strategic organization. Yeah,
much more controlled. I was almost going to say, when you first were explaining it, it felt almost like too scripted, like too controlled. But the fact that either one of you can change up the group order, I think still adds a lot more flow to it. Because even you, like I say you as in the DM in this example, after you get to see how everyone's reacting and going, like you just said, like you'd be like, oh, well, the big bad went first, so they're expecting that. Now he can go like third in and have his minions, you know, counter this. And that's kind of a cool idea. Like you said, be more strategic. Where now the big bad can choose, you know, hey, have my little guys go in there and clog up the fighter or whatever, now that you've seen the first round. So it kind of like makes it still flow, where it's not so like, okay, well, we know the boss is going to go first every round change, like, you know, kind of thing. I like it. That's kind of wild. That that definitely adds a lot more. I don't know. It's almost like a turn-based RPG or something.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I don't know if I necessarily would use it personally.
Yeah.
Just because I mean, it's cool, but I don't think it fits the style of play I want personally. Yeah. I did read some of the people reviewing it, and they said that it did increase player engagement between turns. So like having players discuss who will go next, what they're going to do. So what should I do?
Big time.
Which is cool because it keeps people involved, but then it's at the same time, is that really necessarily how it's happening in a battle? I mean, yes, it's D&D, it's fiction, it's fake.
I know.
But you don't have that much time to figure it out when you're actually in combat. So it takes away that aspect of it.
It does feel a lot like allowing metagaming into it, which, I mean, obviously in combat, I feel like a lot of people do just anyways, just for how combat works, because combat's supposed to be sudden, right? And it's happening really fast. Everything's like 5 seconds. Everything's like quick. And so your character is almost reacting versus, you know, proacting, which this play style would be a lot more like proactive. Like they're already thinking ahead, which the player gets to do that, but your character doesn't, especially with other people in the party. Not really, because you're all supposed to be like doing this in the moment. So it definitely kind of changes the game, really. Like, I mean, it's still D&D, obviously. I mean, that kind of really changes combat, like changes the game on how that works, like pretty violently. Like, that's not a subtle change. That's pretty huge. Well, this one's a really short one. I know I said that for the first one, but this one really is. There's no back explanation for the.
Yeah, you said that for the first one. Then you went on like a 20-minute.
I know. I forgot because he was one of the main. So again, I got a lot of these from forum discussions, just people batting around ideas back and forth, which I fully support. And I think that's a really cool thing to do for players and DMs, is to think tank and bounce ideas off each other. Because you can get in your own echo chamber, right? And then you're not really doing anything unique or new, and you feel like you're in a rut, or if you want to mix stuff up. Anyways, that's probably a whole nother topic. But I was saying this earlier. Also, I feel like a lot of other groups are more sexual than we are in our groups.
Yeah.
And this is such a silly little thing that I think is just a good example of homebrew rules that literally mean nothing. So at least the last one I gave, it actually impacted the story and could impact the game. This one literally is silly nothingness. All right. This is like, and it isn't a sexual nature. So this guy, this DM, he wants people's characters to be so flushed and filled out, which makes me think of Baldur's Gate 3 now, where that if you do a male character, you actually do a 1d10 for your male member's size. Like, he makes that a rule at his table. That's what he did. Like, I'm like, why would you do that though? Like, what would be the point of that? And he's like, oh, they don't use it in the story, but you still make it a rule, right? Like,
it has nothing to do with the gameplay at all.
Right. And you know, in Baldur's Gate 3, you did have a member choice of how it looked and everything. I mean, sure, I guess there were a few cutscenes, but it's like,
wow. All right, then.
Why is that a rule? Like, why is that a thing? And that makes me think of, like, I bring that up as an example of people see this game in homebrew ways that I feel like are so unique and so wild that I never would have thought of. Like, without, like, going out of my way to, like, try to read about it or whatever. And not in a sexual way, but that's just the example. But I mean, like, someone thought that much and cared that much that they're like, hey, this is a rule now. It's like, but I won't use this. Like, why do I have to roll for this? But it's just weird. It's just the community and the uniqueness of some of the rules.
I can guarantee I never would have thought of asking a player to do that.
Yeah. And maybe if you're a bard, that's important to you. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I've never played a bard. I couldn't say. Yeah. What a silly little weird out of the way rule. I was just like, yeah, that's pretty wild. I can't believe I read that. And now I had to make you and our listeners suffer that as well.
Yeah, so there you go. I apologize.
You're welcome.
To everybody.
Yeah.
All right. So I guess we'll just keep going on.
Yeah. Go ahead. What's your next one, bud? What's your next one?
Oh, my goodness. So mine relates to the size of the weapon you carry.
Oh, it all comes back around. Oh, it all relates.
20-foot reach. 20-foot reach. Oh, man. So this one, I don't even think this is a homebrew rule. I think people just do this, and I don't even know if it's written in the Dungeon Master Guide, if this is even a rule, or if it's just something that people do, but sheathing and unsheathing a weapon is just a free action. You just get to do it. Like, we do it all the time. I don't even think about doing it when we do a combat. Like, oh, it takes an action to pull your weapon out. That's still dumb. Like, no.
Right.
Yeah,
I wouldn't have thought of that either.
And then people did say that it should take an action for you to pull up a shield. And I'm just like, okay. Instead of a weapon, maybe, or something. I don't know. But I don't know. That's just dumb. It should just all be free action. So that's not even going to count as a homebrew rule right there. That's just something I found. But this is the homebrew rule.
Okay.
And it's using a bonus action to drink a health potion. Now, the 2024 DM's Guide has made this an official rule now that you can use a bonus action to drink a health potion. However, before they had that official rule, people were doing this all the time as a homebrew. 100%. And they were even doing it to the extent of you do it as a bonus action, so you roll to see how much it restores, like you normally do, correct?
Yeah.
However, you can choose to use your action to drink the potion, and you would get the maximum amount of HP from that potion.
Interesting.
So you're not rolling an, oh shoot, I rolled a 2 and I could have had an 8. So I only gave 2 points, but I still have an action now to attack. Or, hey, I'm going to use my action because I'm like bleeding out at 1 hit point and I need to get as much HP back as possible.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
That's cool.
It is. It's not game breaking by any means. I think it's a fair trade off as far as, regardless, you get the normal rule either way, but then you're sacrificing being able to do something else to get higher HP.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a fair trade off. Honestly, I don't even think many people would use the action. They would probably still just roll.
Chance it. Yeah. People are used to rolling it to chance it for the best or worst case scenario. So I feel like you said, I feel like only if you're like, maybe like if you're like a fighter and you're down to like 1 health and you're tapped.
Yeah.
And maybe you would
on or something.
Yeah, exactly. Like dire situation. But otherwise, like I feel like most players would just risk it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Even Baldur's Gate before the 2024 book came out, Baldur's Gate 3.
That was a bonus action.
Was a bonus action.
I feel like Baldur's Gate 3 was a big test run for some rules that they wanted to implement.
Yeah, I could see that 100%.
To see, like,
yeah, that makes sense.
They now have like the cleave, all those. I can't think of what any of them are, but all those little things that your weapon could do on top of the damage.
The proficiency. Yeah, if you're proficient in it, then you got to do like the cleave and the trip. I think there was a trip in there you could do.
Like, basically incorporated that into the new 2024.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't know that. Yeah. Gosh, I need to read that book. I'll read it before Spelljammer.
As I say, once we're done with Strahd here, we're switching to 24 rules.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll definitely read it before Spelljammer for sure.
All right, what you got for your next one?
All right, so my next one is actually kind of cool. I think it would be an interesting discussion. So they talked about this. This isn't like necessarily a goofy one, like some of the other ones I was saying, but
like the second one.
This one was a DM, and I feel like I could see this being common for a lot of DMs to enforce this. It was more of a house rule where if you talked out of character, not saying like metagaming. If you talked out of character metagaming wise, you got hit with a penalty. So for them, it was EXP.
I already love it.
Right. that's what I'm thinking too. So I automatically love that idea. Like, I really did, because I feel like a lot of people, even Critical Role does it. Not all the time. They're obviously more professional and they get to play once a week for the last like 18 years, but do some sort of metagame, right? Oh, I know this person's going to do this, or I know what this is going to happen. It's like, yeah, true, you do. But would your character know that? Like, that's such a huge distinction, especially if you've been playing the game for a long time.
Especially when you're battling like a monster, like, oh, that's a mimic.
Yes.
I know exactly what that is. They make sure you fight it this way. And it's just like,
yeah.
Oh, really? Like,
right.
Sure, your character 2 campaigns ago across one, and that was the first time you played against it, and so you learned how it worked, and now 3 campaigns later after you faced 17 of them.
Yeah, right. It's like, would you have come to that conclusion? Like, you know, obviously we've got several examples in our own campaign, and mostly because we have new players, so we're trying to teach them how things work. But outside of that though, right, I would say that's a decent exception. It's like, oh, you know, a vampire pops up, and it's like, oh, hitting with something that's like
holy water, garlic.
Yeah. Or... yeah. It's like, oh, yeah, hitting with something that's radiant damage. Sunlight. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Hitting, run a radiant damage. I'm like, yeah, but would we know that? How many vampires have our characters faced before the scenario?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, it's like realistically.
That's where I think you could tell them, like, yeah, sure, you know that, but your character doesn't know that. So exactly. I need you to roll me like a history check or something, some type of check related to the type of monster it is, which there's a table out there that this, like, for instance, beasts, oozes, dragons, each of them has like a different ability check that would be rolled for it based on like religion, history, arcana. So I have the table somewhere. It's on my DM screen that I'm building, because I liked that little, I think it's just somebody like homebrewed it, and I was like, I like this,
it's cool,
so I like to use those for that. And they should have to roll for that if they think that their character would know. Like, if they're really gonna argue, no, I think my character would, okay, well, let's roll and find out,
right?
You know, did you listen in school when you were a little boy? Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's like, and you would hope with the goodwill of your party that they would stick to their character, right? So, like, for example, with our Strahd campaign, it's like my artificer, who was a bounty hunter in Waters Deep for last like 100 years, he would know how to hurt a vampire. He hears about science and how to track down someone for a bounty and urban, you know, warfare, kind of like, you know, so to speak. He's not caring about fiction and, you know, what he would consider to be fiction, vampires. Like, what are you talking about? He wouldn't know. Hit him with radiant damage. What are you talking about? Like, you know, so like, he wouldn't know to do. He would just go at it with his same weapons and tools he's been using for the past 100 years. But you'd hope the player would do that versus them suddenly yelling out, like you said, oh, throw holy water on it. Well, why would you do that? You know, first off, why do you have holy water on you? And second of all, why are you throwing it at this random guy in this alleyway that's, you know, attacking you or whatever, you know? And it'd be cool to like, kind of have like a, can you truly explain in character, like why your character would know this knowledge?
Yeah.
And not just BS it, but you'd really know, like, all right, let's say we could argue you're a blood hunter, but was that what you were commonly hunting? Was that like your main arch enemy? Just like a ranger, you know, for rangers, arch enemy is a dragon. Mm-hmm. If you all of a sudden fight, you know, a really giant, if you fought an ooze, would your ranger suddenly know exactly how to tackle it? No, you're especially as dragons. And it's little like things like that where I feel like you got to know your character and know your party to really enforce that. But I think it's worth enforcing, because I think, to me, the whole point of all of us getting together is escapism and to play our characters. You know, speaking from a player's point of view, we're playing as our character. So I want to like imagine myself as that character. So would I know that? I have a very wide, super nerdy range of knowledge of monsters and weapons and stuff just because I'm a mega nerd. So I've got to like, even though in my head I'm like, I don't know what that is. I've got to put that on pause because my artificer may not know what that is. And I have to think that through and then have him react accordingly.
Yeah,
and
critical
I
role.
I feel like...
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I cut you off.
No. I was basically done. Like, okay. And that's the hardest thing to do is to separate that. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I feel like critical role does that to where Matt Mercer will ask his characters, they have an understanding, I feel, though, because he'll ask his characters, would your character know that? Or they'll ask him, would my character know this?
Yeah. Which I think is like way more. I like it being more open like that. Hey, would I know this? Like, discuss it. Would my character? Because, I mean, again, my
artist. Maybe they do. I mean,
right.
Based on your background and things like, yeah, it makes sense that your character would know that information.
Right. Exactly. Because it's like, if you think about it again, if I'm truly role playing, but my artificer is like 140 years old. I don't truly know every last experience he's lived through before Curse of Strahd.
Right.
So we could have a sudden discussion of, wait, in my travels and you know, Waterdeep, would I know that? Is that something?
Yeah, and then that's where you could almost quickly, without like bogging down the game session.
Yes.
You could almost develop your character's backstory even more. For instance, you're in Waterdeep, and do I know anything about vampires? Well, what were you tracking as a bounty hunter mostly? Were you just hunting down thieves and criminals, or were you hunting like animals or beasts, specific beasts of some sort? And then you could say, well, I think I'd be hunting probably just thieves and thugs. Okay, then no, your character wouldn't. Or, no, I was specifically hunting werewolves and skeletons, zombies, types of creatures. Like, okay, cool. Well, now we know in the future that's what you were hunting. So if you come across another creature that you ask, hey, would I know this information? No, you wouldn't, because you were already studying zombies, things like that. So, you know, you kind of tweak it to where you get the advantage in the moment, but then in the future, it's like, oh, shoot, maybe, you're right.
Yeah.
You develop your backstory as you kind of play, too, as well, a little bit.
Yeah, so, which is cool.
Yeah, my question is, what would be the negative effects that you would have?
Oh, well,
you said for example, did XP.
Yeah. So like for our games, that wouldn't work because we do by milestones.
Right.
So XP would be, you know, like non-existent.
Yeah. So would you take away inspiration if they have it?
Ooh, that's a fun idea.
Or they get like a minus like a D4 to their next ability check or something.
You could do that. You could even do like, whatever your next, like, if you roll an advantage for something, you just roll regular.
Your next roll is just at disadvantage in general.
Or that too. Yeah.
Because that would just take that away as well.
Yeah. You could just straight up be like, all right, well, your next, you know, ability check roll.
There's options. I think you'd have to discuss it as a group at session zero.
Oh yeah. I mean, you would
see what people would want to do.
Yeah. Cause they would have to be prepared.
Yeah. I mean, all of this, you should discuss at session zero with your players to see if you want to bring it into your game.
Yes. Never blindside anybody with a surprise rule. That is not fun for anybody involved. But yeah, I think you're right. I think that you should talk to it first, but you know, cause the mentality is, you know, God willing that people are already coming in with the expectation that they are going to play their character. That's like literally the point of the game, but to help kind of like narrow that in to the right place. Hey guys, there's going to be a penalty if you start mitigating me like too much, you know?
Yeah.
Cool. You know, again, with new players, it's one thing, but right, anyway, sorry I said that. Carry on. What's your next one? Hit me.
So I'm going to combine two of them here because they both deal with the same thing and they're kind of similar. If you ever take damage that is more than half of your current health, you have to make a constitution saving throw. For instance, if you start at 40 health is your full amount of health and you take 20 damage, you have to make a constitution saving throw. If you take 15 damage, you don't. If you take 25, you do. Now let's say you're down to 30 points of health and your maximum points is 40. If you take 15 points of damage, you have to make a constitution saving throw because your current health is at 30. If you take 10, you don't. Above 15, you do. So on and so forth, as you keep dwindling your health points, it's more likely this is going to happen more probably.
Yeah.
So you make your constitution save, and they didn't actually put a number in there, but I would probably say it's 10 because that just seems fair. And if you fail, you get one level of exhaustion because you're taking such a brute force hit compared to what you have left in you.
Okay.
Which physically makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
So the second half of this is also deals with exhaustion. Different rule entirely, but still it's just the exhaustion part. When you're reduced to 0 hit points, you automatically gain one level of exhaustion. A long rest can remove one level of exhaustion, but sleeping in a comfy place, like an inn that has a bed compared to like the floor of a dungeon. So yeah, if you sleep in a comfy place, you can actually remove 2 levels of exhaustion. So you could almost put those rules together, or you could do them separate, where if you take half of your current health, you get a level of exhaustion. And then if you reduce to 0 hit points, you also get a level of exhaustion. And then you could add in that long rest of, I believe long rest, does it do one level of exhaustion generally, or is it, I think that's what it is, right? That's the normal role.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's only it one level of exhaustion per long rest.
Yeah. I don't know if short rest do it or not. I don't think they do.
I don't think they do.
I feel like we should know the answer, but
I think we should.
We haven't come across of exhaustion very much.
Not very much. The only time we really hit it was within the cold in the mountains.
Yeah.
Before we fought the werewolves, and we all only had at least one, I think.
Yep.
And we long rested right after, so we were all good. I think only long rest takes it off, I think.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good rule if you really want to incorporate more of exhaustion in your game. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's necessary. I don't think this is one that I would use personally.
Yeah. That almost be like if you plan your campaign to be like super combat heavy and you want to give it an extra like flair or
you want to make combat a lot harder.
Yes. Yeah. That would be cool. Or maybe even the flip side, if your combats are super rare, like you're more story based, then the combats should be really hard and engaging because your characters don't do it very often. Like that would be kind of a cool thing to bring in.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, there's another one here too, where if you drop to 0 hit points, then you drop prone like normal. Like everything happens like normal, but so it's basically all the normal stuff, but you get 5 feet of prone movement. And you just can't stand up. So basically you're like crawling as you're bleeding out.
Oh, interesting. So you're not
necessarily unconscious. You can't do any of the other things that you normally, you basically just get 5 feet of movement.
Okay. Do you like to try to crawl away or something? Crawl to someone? So that's kind of interesting.
It's not game breaking at all, I don't think.
It's kind of cool though. It's kind of a cool idea of, you know, getting knocked down. I mean, there's a lot of like,
it's more of I think for the flavor of
100%
of combat of as your ally crawls to you, you see the last blow strike them in their back, sending them to their grave.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. There's a couple of course I say that now and I'm trying to think of specifically a video game that did it. There's a few video games like co-op games that were like that, where you could get downed and in Borderlands you were stuck where you were.
So this comes down, from one of those games.
Yeah. Oh, does it really?
Yes, it comes from a video game that somebody saw that.
Oh man.
Yeah, it might have been Borderlands or something, but I can't remember the game.
Because there's one where if you get down, you could still, it was very slow, but you could at least still crawl to your teammates
to get behind cover or something.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So they could pick you up without getting shot to death.
Yeah.
Man, what game was that? Oh, my brain. I've definitely played that 100%. That's fun. That's cool.
In multiple games, but
probably
it's not a terrible rule. I don't love it. I don't hate it. Would I use it?
Yeah.
Probably not.
Yeah.
I just wouldn't. It's not that big of a game-changing rule to where it makes me want to use it.
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, but if cool, my though. If like you guys wanted to use it, I'd be like, yeah, that's fine, we can use it. Like I yeah. It's a rule that I wouldn't say no to, but I probably wouldn't bring it up either.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's right in the right in the middle, I'd say.
For me. Right in the middle. Flavor Town.
That's right. All right, what you got for your next one?
All right, so my next one's kind of a cool idea. This DM, he took out inspiration points. And he brought in what he calls heroic inspiration, which I know is just like word spaghetti, but
you know, the new DM's guide now calls it heroic inspiration.
Does it now? Okay. Yeah. Well, this was back in 2017 when this post was made. So way before the new rule book, but so for this guy, he called it heroic inspiration, ironically. So instead of, you know, the normal how inspiration works, you would get this ability, which kind of matches with something you were talking about in a one shot before, where if you have it, and obviously you talk about it with the DM, you basically get to do something like crazy, but it automatically succeeds. So the example he gave several, but the one that I liked was they're in a fight with a six-headed Hydra. And the fighter gets on the back of this thing and he uses his heroic inspiration because I guess he had like a magical like a fire sword. He wasn't very specific of what the sword was or anything. And he said he uses his inspiration to basically whirlwind on the back of the Hydra, cutting off all the heads at once. And the fire would cauterize the neck so they can't grow back, killing the Hydra with his magical sword. And he used the heroic inspiration, ergo it was an automatic. We talked about it. That makes sense to me. I'll let you do that.
That seems pretty game breaking right there. Just to kill it seems pretty game breaking. One shot like that.
Yes. Well, he had to have the right like tools. He had to have the ability to get up on the
still, Hydra. I feel like the Hydra would have to be pretty low on hit points for it to be allowed.
Well, he didn't go into all that detail. That was just the example he gave. Now, here's the thing, though. Because, yes, as you pointed out, that is very powerful. Now, he also gave away some really, like, funny ones, really cool ones. Like, this one rogue was, like, super low on gold, and he needed the gold to pay off someone, like, desperately.
Okay. Yep.
So he goes into an inn, and he walks in there, and he says, are there flies flying around? And the guy's like, yeah. So he goes up to this guy making bets at a poker table, and he's like, hey, I bet you all 100 gold each that I can shoot the wings off that fly without killing it. And he uses heroic inspiration to basically succeed in it. So he'd get the money, save his ass, and move on.
Yeah.
So again, there are instances that this is pretty extreme, right?
Yeah.
So how you get it, and this is where he was like having a hard time kind of like nailing down an exact example. But I'll give you the one he gave. How you get it, you have to do something that's truly like big, like a big epic moment. And you have to nail every single role and pass whatever you're doing to do this epic event to then get heroic inspiration.
So it's really hard to get in the first place.
Yes.
Okay. That makes more sense on why it would be game breaking.
Right. So it wasn't like a cool, like, oh, I really love
it. I thought you were that. Yeah. Mate.
So the example he gave was, it was a fighter and he's saying that this cliff and there's an orc leader at the end. And he had his friend who was a prisoner at the end of this cliff. And they're standing there and they're talking. He's trying to negotiate with this orc. And the orc's like, you know, all right, you're not winning me over. So screw you. And pushes the prisoner off the cliff. So what the fighter did was, what he does is he runs, tackles the orc to use the orc to brace himself to fall off the cliff because they're falling.
Yep.
Then he had a roll to save the friend to also grab him onto the orc. So when they landed on the orc, obviously instantly killing the orc, taking minimal damage, like half fall damage or whatever. So if he hit every single roll properly, the strength check to hit the orc, the dexterity check, whatever, or acrobatics check to grab the friend. He had to hit every single thing, and then they'd have to roll, you know, a dexterity save for the landing to make sure they land on the orc. Then if he got that, boom, heroic inspiration. Here you go.
Yeah.
You did it. See, but if you failed at any one of those roles, you're out.
Yeah, when you first said that, I thought it was just replacing inspiration in general. So it was just inspiration. So it makes sense that I'm assuming you would get regular inspiration in this game as well. And then you'd have another heroic inspiration.
He removed it. Okay. He said you only got to use this and that's it.
Okay. All right.
So you have to come up with scenarios where you can think of like, I can make this big and epic and cool.
You have to also give your players options too, to be able to have those scenarios happen.
Now that's very true. And he didn't go into all that, but that's very, very, very true.
How do I feel about that?
Which makes them quite rare, right? It makes it really rare to come across a moment where you could impress and succeed all your roles.
So I think as a player, I give it a 7 out of 10. I'm getting into a rating system now. As a DM, I give it a 5 out of 10 because I like it, but I don't like how game breaking it is in the end. I get that it's a lot of work to get it, but I feel that there should be some sort of limitation on what you can use it for.
Sure.
Because to be able to cut off all 5 heads, it makes sense with whatever weapon he had. But you have a Hydra at, I don't know how many hit points now, 200 hit points, full health. Combat begins. I'm doing it first round. I succeed. Yeah. Game over. Yeah. Combat's done. Moving on.
I don't know.
Like, I feel like,
and like I said,
it should be at least under half health or almost dying or something, quarter health. I don't know.
Sure, and that could have been the discussion. Like I said, he did not give the full rundown on what the combat situation was. They could have been fighting this thing for a whole session, and like you said, maybe it was pretty wounded. Maybe the reason why it had 6 heads is because they've already lobbed off several heads and failed miserably, you know? So he didn't give like a full breakdown, but I agree with you. I feel like, and that's also something that I think is not only extremely easy to talk about and negotiate on, and because I mean, like, yeah, also to be a player, I mean, for me, I know there are players out there like this, but to me, to walk into a Hydra fight and one shot in the first round, that's boring AF. Yeah. I'm not here to one shot Hydras. Good Lord. Like, why would I want to do that? Like, we're here to have fun. I want to have fun and fight this thing and barely make it out with my arms intact. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't want to just one shot stuff. But I know there are players out there in the world who absolutely thrive on doing things like that. But
yeah, you get to the big, bad, evil guy at the end. Yeah, I'd like to use my heroic inspiration to slice his head off. Game over.
Right. Yeah. And maybe that's where the DM is.
But he has 1,000 hit points.
Maybe you can't, but maybe look for a moment in the fight where you can use heroic inspiration.
Yeah.
Like XYZ you're talking about.
To maybe remove a limb or something.
Yeah, exactly. Like it takes one of his actions or something, whatever. But anyways, but it's a cool idea. See, it gets you talking, thinking about it. I think it's an interesting idea. I do think he was very limited on examples, which is why we're questioning it so much. But I think the idea is really fun and solid. It makes me think of, which I think we talked about it on the podcast before, the one shot where you had the DM that was like, you have one moment, you've got like a coin, and it gives you one moment where if you're like, hey, my character prepared for this, I can do this thing in this moment, if it fits, you know, the story, that he would allow you to do it. And it's like, kind of like that, just to like
an extreme.
That's it. To an extreme. That's exactly it.
Yeah. And being kind of cool. Yeah. You can easily, you know, lower the extremity of that. Is that a word? Extremity? Extreme.
Yeah, right?
Am I using that right? I don't know.
The internet will let us know if it's not. Don't
My wife always tells me I make words out. She's like, what is that? I was like, it's a combination of this word and that in this word. And it just, they both came out together.
English. Which is English. Let's be honest.
Anyways. Yeah, you could make that however severe you want it to be.
Yeah.
But so I don't know about you. I have a lot more that we can go through. Do you?
I do. Okay. I do. I have like 3 or 4 more,
so
actually.
We'll say that this is part 1 of 2, maybe 3. We'll say, I'm guessing 2. So this will be part 1. I'm guessing at least 2. So okay. This will be the last one. because we are running to our time.
Yeah, we are.
So I have two that I found that I absolutely loved. So I will share one of them now, and I will share one of them on part two episode. So
okay.
Make those listeners, you know, come back and squirm in their chairs.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
And I think you're going to love this one too.
Ooh.
This one deals with critical hits, specifically in combat. So you roll a d20 on your attack. You get your critical hit. You roll the dice, your damage dice, like normal. So if it's a d8, you roll your d8, you get, okay, I got a 4. And then you add your modifier or whatever to it, your bonus or whatever. Okay, I did 6 total damage. Okay, now we have to do the additional critical hit damage. Instead of rolling the dice again, you automatically take the maximum value of that dice.
Oh.
So that way, because this happened in our camp, Curse of Strahd camping, this literally happened in combat either last session or the session before, where one of you rolled a critical, they got a critical hit, they got a 20, but you only did like 14 points of damage because you rolled so bad on your hit dice. You rolled like a 2 for the first one and then like a 1 for the second one. And I just, I remember you, whoever it was, they were like so devastated. They're like, oh.
Yes.
And it takes that away entirely because you know you're getting maximum hit points from the additional dice, which means you're not going to be doing, you know, you're actually going to do a good amount of damage where compared to, oh, I literally did less damage than the person next to me did when they hit with a 14 and they rolled one dice.
Yeah. Oof. Right. Yeah.
So vice versa, I would get to do that with my monsters as well. So it goes both ways.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I feel like that should be true for all rules. It apply NPCs get it just like players. It's fair. It's the world. Yeah, I agree.
So I like that a lot because
I do like it a lot too.
It makes the critical hits even more exciting when you see it because you know you're doing a lot of damage then. You're not just, oh man, there's still a chance I could do bad.
Yeah.
So I do like that. I do like that rule. And then there's
I do too.
A second option to go with that to where if you get a critical hit, and let's say you have 30 points of damage that you get to do on the monster, and the monster only has 20 points of health, you would have to flavor it in a way that makes sense during the session, during the battle. Mm-hmm. But that additional 10 damage that just gets wasted instead goes on to a different monster. And it would have to be this a monster of the same type, so same AC, blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
So for instance, if there's, you know, we go back to Curse of Strahd, a zombie in front of you or a vampire spawn, and then there's one behind that and you're across the room and you shoot your crossbow bolt and you get a critical hit and it goes right into the eye of the first zombie and there's still 10 points left. It goes through their skull and hits the second zombie behind them. They take an additional 10 points of damage.
That's cool.
Or, you know, I swing my sword and I, you know, you kill them with the first blow and there's one standing next to you that you're able to hit with as you're coming across and they take that remaining damage. You'd have to flavor in a way that works.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, with anything, that's how it should be. Right.
Even
yeah,
if I totally agree. There's not a physical way, like, well, it doesn't make sense that I have the sword and then I cut the zombie and then the one 20 feet over there gets cut by my sword. I have to throw it and I don't want to lose my weapon. And this isn't Thor's hammer that's going to come back to me.
Right, right.
So you'd have to be like, oh, and then all of a sudden a tree limb fell on the other zombie over there. And it took 10 points of damage. Like, it's stupid, yes. And,
right.
But it works.
It's fun, though. Yeah.
Like, we're here to have fun.
The, of course, I don't know 10th edition for Warhammer, but the old melee, when all the squads, because it's supposed to be a giant melee of, like, you know, 10v10 units or whoever it is, whatever your armies are. And like, if it's called momentum, it carries momentum. So if like the space marine has a power sword and he cuts through an orc, but it does 2 wounds, the orc went down in 1 wound, it's considered that the momentum of him slashing the sword carried him into the next guy standing next to it, because you're all supposed to be in it, you know, together, like in a mosh pit. And so it's like, it's kind of cool to like put that over into D&D, because it's like, yeah, man, like if you're kicking butt and like you're swinging around like a giant bastard sword, you're going to cleave two people in half.
But it only works on critical hits. So like not.
Right.
Like a regular, I hit the monster, there's leftover damage. It does not work for that. It's only critical
hits. Right. It's got to be like a special event. Yeah. Critical hit. Makes sense. Yeah. 100%.
Which are pretty rare, honestly. Like,
which are pretty rare.
Maybe one of them on average. I don't know. Yeah, maybe it's just we have terrible dice.
We have terrible dice. We all need to buy new dice immediately.
There's battles that we'll go into and nobody gets one. And then nobody gets one on the next battle. And then the next. And then all of a sudden we get like four of them in one battle.
We did. Yeah, we did. That one fight. Like everyone at least got one critical hit, which was crazy.
Yeah, I'd say there's probably on average, probably I'd say one per battle.
Sure.
I would hope at least. That's a party of four. That's probably a high average statistically, I know, for all the math people out there, but whatever.
Oh, they're out there. They're waiting. They've got their calculators
It's not going to be more than one a battle on average. So it's not like this is game breaking in any way, but it adds, it makes critical hits so much more intense. Like when you get to do it, so much more exciting. But when I get to do it, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? Am I going to die?
Yeah. And I think that's the thing. Like, I like that in general, and I'm not going to go into this because we're about out of time, but I like anything that hypes up natural 20s and ones. Like, I feel like the spectrum, because you don't roll at ones that often, but when you do, you failed. And like, when you hit those 20s, they should be like, oh, like this was the moment that you were called for. You hit a 20. And like, I love anything that plays into that. And that obviously heavily does, which is so much fun. I love that. That's so cool.
That's actually
highs and lows.
I think that's one of the rules has to deal with a natural one that's on my list yet to come, but we'll get there.
Oh yeah.
Not yet. We'll get there.
Yeah.
But I think so. If, you know, to keep those listeners out there interested, here's my pitch to you. Next episode, part two of this, I'm going to start off with a homebrew rule that will get the new players to want to keep playing.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And it's not just their member size. Got it.
It's not just what? Oh my gosh. Ah, jeez. there it is.
That's right. Got to keep them interested somehow, man. Got to keep them coming back. Anything.
If that's how you're doing it, man, I don't know.
Someone's doing it, not me.
Goodness. That's the only way that guy can get his people to keep playing.
Imagine what his group sessions are like. Don't imagine. It's not worth it.
I bet they all play Stick Bards. Stick to
the D&D kids. Oh, 100%.
We have six bards 100%. In our group.
seducing across the land. Oh, goodness. God.
We have a lot more to go over, which we will go over in part two of this homebrew rules segment. So we appreciate you all sticking around, and we look forward to talking to you next time. So thanks for stopping by, and have safe travels as you adventure forth.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on Not Just NPCs Podcast.